You're listening to episode 28 of the National Centre for Writing podcast with me, Simon Jones. Every week we talk about the writing life and discover exciting new projects, and we're definitely doing that today. It's Wednesday, 16th of January, here at Dragon Hall in Norwich, and this week we're having a chat with Tom Abber. Tom is a specialist in the convergence of narrative, books, and future platforms for storytelling and design, which means he experiments with fascinating new ways to tell stories. From 2016, this has taken the form of the Ambient Literature Project, which has created numerous technology-enabled narratives. You can check most of them out for free over at their website at ambientlit.com. In 2018, Tom made it onto the list of the bookseller's 40 most disruptive innovators in publishing, after which I knew we needed to get him on the podcast. So here's Tom, who I spoke with just before the end of last year. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the time today to be on the podcast.
Hello, Simon, and you're completely welcome.
So if I've got my timeline right, Ambient Literature was set up back in the summer of 2016, is that right?
More or less. I mean, the way these things work are you dream up two words, you put them together, you write a funding bid, you send it off to a funding council, they peer review it, you panic, you write a fairly robust defence. The first time we used the term is probably about 2013, 2014, as a way of thinking about the kind of practice that we were interested in both making and critically understanding as well.
Yeah, so it was kind of a long gestating project before it actually then came to be.
They all are, yeah. But you're right, actually. We started kind of in anger, if you like, in sort of May, June 2016, and then had 2 and a bit years so of that first funded period.
I suppose what we should do for people listening who don't necessarily know the work yet is talk a little bit about the project so that people have a better sense of what they are.
Yeah.
Because in terms of describing them to people who have not encountered them before, you can start off with the notions of like what a print book is and what an ebook is, and you can have video games, and your projects kind of take a lot of those things, mix them together into something completely new.
They do, yeah. So it's probably... the easiest ones to talk about, well, they're all, but if we do Breathe, then it must have been dark by then, and I'll talk about the other two a little bit. So Breathe, which is Kate Pullinger's piece, is best described as a ghost story that haunts you. It knows where you are. It's delivered as a web app, so it's a website with URLs. There's no app to download. You just go there, and all these things are free, incidentally, for your readers. They are free. We're giving them away. And what Breathe is a story about a girl called Flo who can talk to ghosts. And it's a short piece. It takes about 15, 20 minutes to read, depending on what your reading rate is like. It's familiar in that it uses pages. The page term metaphor is something that Visual Editions kept very early on in those conversations with Google 3 or 4 years ago. But what it does mechanically, effectively, if you like, is it reads API data from the world around you. So it knows where you are. It knows where the nearest cafe is. It knows where the nearest train station is, what the road you're on. It knows what time of day it is, and it knows what the weather's like. So there's a sort of dual layer of haunting going on in there, that there are moments in the piece that absolutely use the phone as a device and the way you're holding it, where the ghosts that Flo is talking to can talk to you as well. And they reference the world around you. And that's kind of the most immediate haunting. For me, there's another layer of haunting that is absolutely ethereally beautiful that nobody ever notices, is that because it knows what time of day it is, that if it is the afternoon in the real world, it's the afternoon in the story. If it's raining in the real world, it's raining in the story. And that sounds incredibly subtle, and it's beautifully written, and Kate did an astonishing job on, there are layers of this, of the text, that nobody notices changes. What I think is particularly powerful is because you're brought into a space where the story is set where you are. Does that make sense? That the time of day and the weather are reflected outside and within your phone. That when those ghost voices break through, when they actually properly kind of haunt you in a properly uncanny way, the affect is much, much more powerful than if it had just been there are voices that are going to know where you are. The fact that there's a kind of layer that you're brought in. I'm trying hard to describe it because it's a very weird thing to unpack, but I think it's a particularly powerful bit of writing that borrows technology and uses what technology does in order to deliver one precise thing, and that's to make you feel uneasy. And that was always Kate's aim. On the other end, almost on the other end of the scale, it must have been dark by then, is a piece that has, you have a physical book in your hand and you have an app and you wear headphones and you're going to go on a walk and we're going to send you across a city, or actually any space anywhere in the world. And it must have been dark by then is about change, and it's about societal and climate change. And the first time I did a demo version, I kind of came back into the studio and Duncan looked at me and he said, "What did you think?" And I said, "It's the enunciation of the Anthropocene." It's incredible. I find it scary. I find it really waking up. Duncan went on, and all the writers had about 9 months to work on these. So that's hence the overlap between each one. Duncan went to three sites around the world that are undergoing or about to undergo massive change. He went to the Russian-Latvian border, where there are towns that are going to be probably gone in two or three generations. There's no infrastructure left. There's one electrician for 4,000 people. It's the story of a younger generation that is moving out and the older generation are dying. And he went to the Tunisian Sahara, where they've given up on trying to protect against the desert. And so again, there are these people living with an incredibly powerful impending change, an impending kind of environmental change around them. And the one that I always end up saying favorite, and it's not, but the one I found most profoundly affecting is the wetlands and swamplands and fishing communities around New Orleans, where post Katrina, there is now a 27.5-foot concrete wall around the larger suburban, but basically around New Orleans. And it's the biggest national engineering project ever undertaken by the Corps of Engineers. And what it means is if you live inside that wall, then there is federal funding for disaster relief and all the things that you would expect from a civilized society. And if you live outside the wall, there is nothing. And the next time a hurricane hits, that's it, it's gone. And what the piece does is take field recordings, take stories, take the dialogue, and take the interviews that Duncan did when he went with a local artist, a local kind of interviewer for each one of each location. And it on one level, those are laid into the book, so you read the book as you walk. But actually, what the piece does is does what we call generative GPS. So conventional GPS pieces have a set of points on a map that you walk through. And that's a technology that we've used before. It's kind of proven. We know what we're doing. The only difficulty is big, tall buildings because they cast shadows and satellites can't see through them. But what It Must Have Been Dark by Then does is make a map as you walk. So you have a voice in your ears that's guiding you and instructing you, and it asks you to walk and to walk for a while. It might at certain points ask you to find a place where people live, or a junction, or water, or at the end of your outward journey, because there's an outward and a return journey, it'll ask you to find a barrier you can't go beyond. And all these kind of, you can call them fragments of story from around the world that Duncan found, are then kind of relayed to you in those places. So what it does is build up a map that's unique to you, that is, in effect, a kind of invisible sound sculpture that sits across the city. And so you have an interface that's building up this set of blue dots that you've walked through, that you take a journey out, and it'll probably take you about 45 minutes an hour. And then the voice says, "Okay, that's it. You can put the book away now. And we're going to ask you to walk back through the map you've made." And you walk back to the place you started. And at that point, the layer of anthropocenic Timothy Morton esque thinking kind of lays on, and you really understand what this piece is about. This piece is about change, it's about responsibility, and it's about the Anthropocene. And so, sorry, that was my very long way of saying we have bits completely at the end of the scale that really try to deal with the potential of technology and storytelling in completely different ways. And then The Cartographer's Confession, which James Attlee wrote, is a kind of more conventional, if you like, GPS-driven piece. But it's really ambitious in its scale. It's set in London. It's about migration, and it's about family histories. And it does some incredibly clever things with time and where you are. Almost to say any more would be a spoiler. And then the Hay Festival came along toward the end of the project and commissioned a final piece from us that was designed for an interior space that we're looking to tour later, actually probably this time next year.
Yeah, it's such a wide-ranging mix of stuff. And like you say, it's all accessible, isn't it? It's available for people to go and try it out themselves.
Absolutely, yeah. So Breathe is breathe-story.com. The Cartographer's Confession and It Must Have Been Dark By Then are available in the App Store. For It Must Have Been Dark By Then, you need to buy the book unless you come to an event where we're running it, because the book costs money and that means we can make more of them. Words We Never Wrote, the Hay piece, is... I mean, it's slightly limited in that we need to install it in a location. But I say the plan is that we'll tour that in the Southwest initially, sort of this time next year, and then start seeing how it's taking it further.
Yeah. I think what's fascinating about most of them is that they're using the reader, their local context, to add kind of depth to what the authors have actually created.
Absolutely. And it's something that... there's a real tension in making these kind of works, in fact making any digital work, between what you might call the illusion of agency. So as a writer, you have a responsibility to the reader, to the audience, that you hopefully you know what you're doing, and you're making an experience or a story that is affecting, that is powerful, that is complete, that has all the things that we want. But actually, because of the mode of this technology, then that audience will expect to have some kind of agency in how it's delivered and how it's experienced. So on the one hand, you know, you could look at something like Breathe and say there's very little agency there, but there's quite a lot in terms of where you are, and where you are brings the story in. It Must Have Been Dark By Then is loaded with agency because you're making the decisions about where you go. Words We Never Wrote has a non-linear middle. It's a beginning and an end, and the middle bit is more like kind of Johnson's The Unfortunates, in that you choose the order of you get the story, which is an incredibly difficult thing to write within a space. But absolutely, I always said it was a really clumsy description, but actually it's not that clumsy. Is that when the line for the project was situated or site responsive storytelling mediated by a digital device and responsive to the presence of a reader. And that last bit, I think, became the most important thing. The responsive to the presence of a reader, that these are activated by readers and readers kind of perform within them in some way. But when they're finished, they sort of go away again. They sort of fade back into the environment. Audiences for It Must Have Been Dark, and they talked about their experience of London or Bristol, or we run that piece in Denmark and in Canada and the States, that they don't see their own city the same way again. It's got this kind of invisible layer of audio laid over it, which is a really beautiful way of describing things.
Yeah, and what was the impetus behind setting up Ambient Literature? So, you know, it sounds like this was something that was in your brain for a long time with other people.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, there were sort of pragmatic reasons and there were opportunities. Mm. So I've been making work with Duncan Speakman Duncan's case, sort of the best part of a decade, for mine, a little bit less, that was about site and site responsiveness and storytelling and digital devices. We'd made a piece called These Pages Fall Like Ash, which we had Neil Gaiman and Nick Harkaway working on, that was a distributed story set in a city about, and it was shamelessly borrowed from China Miéville, City in the City, from Niels Neverwhere, from all those stories of parallel cities. But we were interested in, can you make something that was interdependent, that had a physical book and a digital component? And that was probably the first time we really started thinking about, there is a thing here. There is a form that we're starting to work in that borrows from work that we've seen and that we've made and that we're aware of, but we start to kind of articulate that in a particular way, and got interested in a sense, the opportunity is, because I'm an academic as well as an artist and a writer, is if you have 2 years to do something, you get to go really deep and understand what it is.
Right now, you know, a few years later, you've got a notion of what ambient literature is and how you define it. But back in those early days, when you were starting out and you had this kind of, this notion, this spark of what it could be, but how did you figure out which projects to work on first and where to put your efforts?
I was really public, and I went online and went to the blog, and there was a bookseller piece when we launched in London in 2016. They were saying, we don't know what it is. We have some sense about what it might be, but we want to use this. I think there were some practical reasons. So the plan was always we'd have three commissioned works that would be exploring the space. And three commissioned works don't make a whole genre, but they get you somewhere. And we were going to make small experiments around the edge and then as we'll probably come on to, there was a surprise fourth commission. I think we always knew that the plan would be the backbone of the project would be these three works that would go out into the world, find an audience, hopefully, and that we'd have something to conduct some fairly rigorous user evaluation with, to understand what readers, if we call them readers, if we call them participants or actors, understood by these things, to understand how they operate in terms of their narrative function, of what they are. And actually, slightly came down to a pragmatic decision. So Duncan was first out of the gate. We had Duncan Speakman, we had James Attlee and Kate Pullinger. And there was some weighing up of what that might be, but Duncan probably came in with the most formed idea of what he wanted to make. And so in terms of just keeping us sane, and rather than thinking that we're going to make three at once and making one, then an overlap with two and an overlap with three, it sort of made sense that what became It Must Have Been Dark by Then was the first piece that we both made. We started thinking about. There are obviously conversations in there about the technology and what you're trying to do, and being ambitious, but also being, I would say, cautious, but kind of competent about what you're trying mm-hmm. to achieve. So there is a, when a thing goes out into the world, that we're confident that it works, that what we're trying to achieve it demonstrates, and that really happily, and this was kind of one of those, you have a process of working with artists and working with writers that we were very determined early on, and we were quite upfront with them, said, we're not going to tell you what to do. We're going to slightly sit on your shoulders and talk to you, but we're not going to direct you. And we certainly didn't, we're not going to make you make kind of what you might see as iterative work. So, you know, so that James's would build on Duncan's, Kate would build on James's. It was, you have freedom. And so we got three very different pieces of work, very different scales, very different ambitions, and in very different places. And I think even though that was a massive headache at times of dealing with those technologically, I'm really happy that the end result is a really kind of varied set of works.
Yeah, I think what's fascinating about them as well is that you had all the kind of challenges you get with any creative project, but then you additionally had a lot of the challenges that you would normally associate perhaps with a software project and the development of a bit of technology and trying to adjust that scope at the same time.
Absolutely. We worked with a Bristol developer called Calvium for the first two. We worked with Kate's. We were approached by Visual Editions, who've had a relationship with Google Creative Labs in Australia and Sydney. And they were really interested in working with Kate, and it fitted what they wanted to do. So we went with Google, which is, you know, we have Google. Wow, okay. There's a thing for Breathe. And then for the fourth commission, because really on the time scale, I work with a third year creative media design student at the university. So we went, you know, complete scales of these things. But within that, there is the idea that you're trying to build something new, but you want to use technology that already exists in interesting ways. And so, and also the bottom line for us was that we're going to use phones. We're not going to build a new piece of kit. We might ask you as a reader, as a participant, to interact with your phone in a way you've not done before. And we might ask some difficult things about that, but we're not making a new Kindle. We're absolutely using something that you carry around in your pocket all the time.
I'm really curious as to how readers have reacted to this, because I can imagine the notion of agency within the text, if you like, for readers of books, that's quite a new and potentially disruptive thing. And then you've got an audience of perhaps people who have grown up playing video games who expect that but haven't encountered it in book form before.
Yeah, and I think the crossover audience, and this is a bit slightly clumsy, is immersive theatre people. Mm-hmm. People have done Punch Drunk. People have been to things where they've had a similar enough experience to the kind of things we're doing. And we're not making immersive theatre, but I think we do borrow some of that language and some of that kind of formal structures. The reaction to Breathe has been incredible. I think partly because Kate aimed that at a young adult audience and it has a female protagonist. And I think that was a decision Kate took really early on, and we were always really interested in where she took that. But that, you know, in the current climate, that has done that piece of work no harm at all. It Must Have Been Dark by Then, I think, has a more, I don't want to say, not cerebral, but it reaches people in a different way. It has quite a complex relationship in terms of what you're doing, that you're walking, you're reading, you're listening, you are building this map and you're learning the system as you go along. I think it takes people maybe 10, 20 minutes to get used to that in how it operates. But because it's actually quite a simple rule, and this is the other thing that we found on this, is it, I've been, in terms of the book that will accompany the end of the project, or the next bit rather, I'm looking at the poetics, I'm looking at the writing and the how do you compose in this space. And one of the things that I'm realizing, looking kind of almost a sort of deep textual analysis of all the work we've made, is that they all, there are things that we know this stuff does, that we did about kind of mapping, about temporality, about control, and they all do one or two of those things really well, but don't try and do everything. And that was a key thing, that wasn't deliberate, but when you look back at the whole thing and you're starting then to put some kind of design dimensions on, you realize that the breeze is asking a specific thing of you, that Words We Never Wrote asks a specific thing of your engagement, that it must have been dark by then, has this kind of complex, and then suddenly it's like you're in the flow and it's there and it all makes sense.
Yeah.
And that, I think that was the thing, that was one of the big, almost retroactive learning, that you learn by doing it and you figure it out. But when you look back and go, okay, that's actually a rule of thumb for these mm-hmm. things.
That's really interesting, because a lot of video game design, which I'm personally interested in, you see designers quite often talk about how in a game design, you should only really introduce one thing that's different to other games. Because if you expect, in that case, the player to pick up loads and loads of new things, it's going to be quite off-putting. Whereas if you just change one thing and do that differently, then it's exciting.
And I think that's completely true for digital technology generally. You know, you're guiding people into an unfamiliar space. And as you quite rightly said, our audiences for this were partly people who play video games, although we were really clear that these are literary experiences. We're interested in story here. And that doesn't mean the two are mutually exclusive, but I think there are lenses through which you view this. And people who read books and wanted something different out of that, we... You know, in varying ways, Kate has an audience, James has an audience, Duncan has an audience, and I do. That kind of awareness of the work we've made before influences the people who come along and do this stuff. So there was always a degree of us foregrounding storytelling as researchers and artists in this. I think that was a really helpful decision at the start. So this is going to be about story, and we want to understand how stories operate in this space, mechanically, poetically, experientially.
Yeah, and I think Breathe works so well as an introduction to all of this, because on the surface, it's presented in a way that is very familiar. You interact with it like you do in an ebook. It's text that you're reading in a fairly linear manner. So on the surface it does that, but then of course there's this all these mechanics behind the scenes adjusting the context of the story.
Completely. And Breathe is so sly. It's so subtle. I hadn't realized until Kate sent me the full script with all the code and everything else with it, how much of that alters and you don't notice it. And that, you know, the thing I said at the start about there's almost a two-layered haunting going on, I think it's an absolute achievement of writing to make that work in such a subtle manner. And then there's this really beautiful moment, I'm not spoiling, where, okay, my analogy for this is, you know, Chris Marker's Le Jeté. The absolute haunting moment in Le Jeté is the one moment in that 30 minutes, 29 and a half minutes of still photography where something moves. Mm-hmm. And it sends a chill down my spine every time I watch it. I used to show it to students every year, and I probably still should. There's a moment in Breathe at the end where you do something that you've not done before. That's all I'll say. There is some other mode that without fail, people report that as the moment where they feel an absolute connection to the story. And it's that you move one thing, you shift the pitch one thing, you set up an expectation about the way it's reading, about this dual layer of haunting, and then Flo asks you to do something at the end, and it's lovely. It's really, really lovely that sense of then there is a real, there's a physical connection as well as an emotional and a poetic and an experiential connection.
Yeah, I'm curious as to, there's kind of an ongoing conversation around all of kind of big data and the amount of information that your phone knows about you and this kind of thing. How have your projects kind of bumped into that in terms of reader reaction around privacy and the fact that the story knows where you are, particularly with Breathe, because it's deliberately a ghost story.
It's deliberately a ghost story. And we were, You know, it's weird. It's not weird. People, this says more about people than it does about Breathe, I think. Everybody's incredibly trusting of that. Of that idea that the phone knows where you are. Nobody questions. I mean, when we did longer interviews, and then those questions come out. But at least in terms of kind of initial reaction, some of the online journalism that was that's been really great over the summer, the press for Breathe, did pick up on that a little bit and kind of just call attention to it slightly. But yeah, no, as readers, I think readers have been great. They've been astonishing. This sense of trusting us as authors, of trusting us as curators of an experience. And I think I wrote a piece, I can't remember where it went, it might be in the bookseller, toward the end of the project. And one of the lines I used is, a smartphone is not a neutral carrier of story. And what I meant by that was a book isn't a neutral carrier of story either, but a book as a technology, I think, very quickly disappears when you're reading. That it becomes, we are so used to this from the moment that we're taught to read when we're 4, 5, or 6 years old, that the technology falls away and we're reading and we're immersed and we're in a story and we're completely following the structure and the rules. And only when writers call attention to that formal quality, and I'm thinking obviously of people like Mike Danielewski with House of Leaves, of Johnson, B.S. Johnson, and obviously there are many, many others, or the entire Lippo group, are we then reminded the thing is a technology in our hand, that the thing is a form, and we're being manipulated to a certain extent. Our relationship with our phones is so much more complicated in terms of the information they hold on us, of the amount of personal data and the hundreds of thousands of messages, of phone calls, of data, of things we hold around them, that I think one of the things that we felt in the entire project was we need to attend to that weirdly personal machine relationship you have with your mobile phone. And really thinking about how are you being asked to respond to the device in your hand? The question I asked all the writers, and not as a kind of persistent, I will continue asking until you go away, was what's the role of the phone in the story? Because it can't be neutral. For Kate, for Breathe, the phone is a book. The phone is, you know, it's, as you said, it's using the form of a book. For Duncan, the phone is a way of mapping the city. It's a way of building that map. For James and Cartographer's Confession, the phone is a container. It's a container for these layers of story that are in there. For Words We Never Wrote, because it's about, the piece actually operates on low-energy Bluetooth beacons, it's about proximity. Your phone goes in your pocket or your bag, and your phone disappears really quickly. And even though its function is to act as the beacon that's bouncing, or the signal for the beacons that are bouncing around a space, I think that sense to which the pieces that we make have to really consider what the technology is and how we relate to it. And that was a really interesting part of the whole thing.
Yeah, and in terms of the existence of the technology and the fact that the projects that you've got here couldn't exist without them, I'm curious as to whether the idea for doing ambient literature came about because this technology now exists, or have you always had some of these notions in your head, but they've only become possible in the last decade?
It's a bit of both, I think. I think, yes, pragmatically, absolutely. Phones exist. Phones are, at least in the Western world, and actually broader than that, are pretty ubiquitous, and then we can do things with them. And there are things that we don't notice, that you don't notice, that have been done with you all the time. I think there are certainly, and I'm probably speaking for Duncan more than for me, there are experiments and things that Duncan's been making pre-smartphone, let's not call it smartphone, pre-iPhone, because smartphones exist before iPhones, and the BlackBerry is well before that, and there's certainly, but pre kind of the form it's taken now, that I think are more possible now with the technology. Not always simpler, but certainly more possible and easier, because the whole thing is packed into this little flat rectangle of glass and steel. But no, I think it's both. I think a lot of the things that we made and we talked about and that we were, I think we've done and we're interested in doing, are not about the technology. They're about experience and immersion and presence. And the technology is actually a really handy way to make those real, to kind of reify them.
Yeah, and I guess the big difference as well in terms of this project being funded and existing is that 10, 20 years ago, you might theoretically have been able to do some of it, but it would only ever have been experienced at, say, a festival, where you'd have had to have delivered bespoke technology and equipment and stuff. Whereas now, you can do these experimental things, but they can be enjoyed by anyone who's got one of these devices.
Completely, and that sense of market is a really key part of what we were doing. That we, you know, we had an advisory board drawn from publishing, from the cultural sector, that kind of kept us honest and asked difficult questions, and they were interested in the market reach of these things. The sense to which we were making work that had an audience was always key. And this comes up to the first thing I said about, you know, what we wanted was these things to be robust, that we know they're going to be out there and that they can be enjoyed, read, experienced. I think there's still a place for bespoke stuff, though. So Duncan, following on from, it must have been dark, but then Duncan's in, kind of, I say, in the middle, getting toward the end of a PhD. And he's just made a piece of work called Only Expansion, which is completely custom kit. It's Raspberry Pi, it's augmented audio. You walk with a book that we made, and on the outside of your headphones are tiny little microphones that remix the world around you into an orchestral movement. And if that sounds weird, it is. The first time I tested it, I told him I wanted my legs back, because it's quite disorienting. But as a piece, it's... I can describe little bits of it. Autumn leaves become remixed into an orchestral piece, the sound of your feet moving through spaces. I had a cold when I did the final version. I still have a bit of a cold now. And I coughed at one point, and it felt like I was in the middle of a 200-foot chamber that echoes back on me. And then I sniffed, and my sniff became a brush on a cymbal. It's completely beautiful. People started playing the piece as a piece. But laid onto this is a similar kind of concern with the Anthropocene, with our responsibility to the planet, with Californian wildfires, with rising sea levels. But it merges into this utterly profound, utterly beautiful piece that, in that case, uses bespoke technology because commercial technology isn't there yet. So I think, you know, on the one hand, we're interested more broadly in how do we reach an audience, but we're also really interested in the kind of the cutting edge bit as well. Where we do sometimes need to build things, because until we've built something and tested it, then we don't know what we want to do with the phone in 5 years' time when it can do that. Mm.
Yes, exactly. So you've had some really great collaborators on all the projects, but I was wondering what kind of response you've had from other creators who you haven't worked with yet, but who have been watching the results of what you've been doing.
Less kind of writing collaborators, more I think we've had a really interesting level of interest from publishing, from the sector, from I think what we've been able to do over 2 years, and Breathe absolutely is a big part of that, because as you said, it's incredibly accessible, and Breathe becomes a kind of gateway drug that opens out the rest of the work, is we've made work that's robust, that feels like storytelling rather than games. That, you know, without a doubt has bits of games language in how it's constructed and how we think about it, but that had storytelling foregrounded. And I think because of that robustness and that sense that we understand how to make these works, I think that's made us interesting in a space where there hasn't been that much kind of innovation. Certainly the last 3 or 4 years, you know, publishing has kind of moved away from digital as an innovation space, and have really, I think, I may be being unfair here, but I've looked at it as a marketplace for content they already have. You know, how do they exploit audio? How do they exploit the ebook? How do they exploit the education sector? I think one of our advisory board reminded me at the end of this whole glorious process that, you know, they'd looked at us as being innovators at a time when everybody else was kind of not quite in, you know, bleak austerity, but certainly kind of pulling their belts in a little bit and trying to figure out what they do next. And we had this space to operate, and you know, without a doubt, it's the sense of, I think personally, in terms of being confident about what we want to make and how we make it, being able to now run workshops with school children, with writers, with writers groups, with whoever you want to run a workshop with, really, and understand that we can give you some design dimensions that are not about you must write it this way, but this is how you get your head around writing this stuff. You know, I've learned more about architecture in the last 9 months than I have most of my life, just for thinking I need a metaphor for how do you build these things. And oddly enough, architecture and the way architects approach space is a really useful way of thinking that through. But that's left us in a really interesting place that, you know, we're now, our initial funding period is over. We have traction, if you like. So we're pivoting toward a lab model to take the whole thing forward.
You mentioned funding there, and I was wondering if there was anything you could share about how the funding came about for other people who, you know, might have ideas and projects in their brains and are looking for ways to explore them.
Our funding was Arts and Humanities Research Council because we're a university, and then we found two other universities because we're UKAIT, and there's an amazingly scarily bright man called Matthew Haler, who's currently living in Saskatoon. Hi, Matt. From the University of Birmingham, who just blows me away every time I talk to him. And we go through a process of applying for funding to make things that are academically interesting, that there is a research agenda, there's a thing we're trying to answer. I think what we've learned is that you do need money to do this stuff. You know, it's difficult to do it without a budget. I think the Arts Council are starting to be interested in this space. And honestly, I mean, I'm making this offer now, and to anybody listening, if you want to talk to us about how you make this, or how we consult, or how we advise, or how we form a tiny part of a project that you want to go and make, we want to talk to you, because what we don't want this to do is to just sit on a university shelf for the next 10 years. I'm really interested in what this looks like if you're a small independent creator, if you're a publisher, if you're a theatre company, if you're a cultural body of some sort that has a thing you want to work with, you think this might be helpful. That might mean we operate at scale or we operate at small scale. I think what I've always known about this space is it's inherently collaborative, is that you can make it all yourself. And I know people who've done that and who go on doing that. But actually, one, there is a joy of collaborating. And two, if you open yourself up to the possibility that your idea might be improved by somebody else talking to you about it, it probably will be.
Yes, I think what's exciting is that you're getting to explore and define what this thing is as you go along. And like you were saying earlier, I think at first glance, it seems a little bit like games. It reminds you of that. Obviously, it has connections to books. But then the more you dig into it, the more you realise that it's perhaps a separate new thing that draws from some of those other areas, but is actually becoming a new form in itself.
That's completely true. And we had this, it was more because Duncan kept moaning at me. We had a debate maybe toward the end of the project as to, were we defining a lens or a thing? And for a while, the idea that ambient literature was a lens through which we looked at work we were making and that work we've made and what we're interested in making in the future and understood it better was a really, I think, safe place to operate from, safe and risky at the same time. But, you know, we're looking at the politics, we're looking at the ethics, we're looking at the poetics, and it's a lens by which we look at work that we've made, other people have made, and all those things. And at some point we start talking about it as a thing, because we realize that that lens also becomes a set of design dimensions, a set of ways of thinking about this work that don't become exclusionary, and that's not how it should, because it doesn't do that. But they're really helpful ways to think about a toolkit and about being able to work with different voices and voices we've not worked with and audiences we've not worked with and make work in ways we've not seen as well. It becomes this kind of, not schizophrenic, but oddly facing in two directions objectness.
And with that initial funding phase complete and having successfully created the projects that you set out to do in the first place, what's next, both in terms of your ideas and ambient literature as an entity?
I kind of alluded earlier, a lab. So we will relaunch the website in a few weeks' time. That's been largely this autumn thinking about what that looks like. The lab kind of operates at three tiers, but they're not really tiers. They're just kind of three ways of thinking about it. One is a workshop model. That can be an hour and a half. It can be a 5-day. It can be a 6-month that we come in and we do something more sandbox-like with an organization or set of organizations. And it can be technology enabled. It can be just the kind of design of a something. But that sense to which that allows us to work with different audiences, different groups, different voices, I think is really interesting. So we're actively looking for what gets called follow-on funding for that, which is when you've had funding from the Arts and Humanities Research Council, you can then apply follow-on funding to do things you couldn't do in the first project. So that's that's quite instrumental on our part. We're also looking for opportunities to work with other organisations. There's consultancy, which we've done a bit of already, of working with brands and organisations who have, let's call it content or assets, and saying what might they do if they wanted to work in this space. And that, again, is it can be a half-hour chat, it can be an ongoing thing, it depends on how far someone's thinking is. And there's commissions, both looking for commissions and being happy to take them, but also trying to get to a position where we can commission new work as well. And some of that will involve changing the way we think about kind of who we are as an organization. And it may involve thinking more in terms of spin out rather than being just a university in that space. But that's the conversation of where we are. And so, yeah, I think we're probably looking at two or three projects in the next year, with certainly once that follow-on funding and the idea of touring Words We Never Wrote kind of comes through, that we're looking at kind of activity toward in that space kind of summer, autumn next year.
Fantastic. And if people want to check out the projects that have already been made or are interested in collaborating, where's the best place for them to go to find out more?
AmbientLit.com is the entire project website. At the moment, as I say, it's where that takes you to is a subdomain called research.ambientlit.com, which is the archive of everything we did for the last 2 years. And in a week or two's time, there will be a landing page that says, do you want to go to the lab or the research? And I think that for me is the really helpful bit about having had 2 years to figure this out, is that it feels like we're launching a business that has a really deep level of understanding of its marketplace at the same time, and that can demonstrate things. And that's incredibly fortunate, and I'm really grateful that we've had that. But ambientlit.com. AmbientLit has a Twitter account. I'm Tom Aver on Twitter. I'm emailable. I'm having a surname that's definitely not named after a Swedish band from the 70s, but they stole it first. It means I'm fairly unique in the world. And the other place maybe to look for us is an organization called the Pervasive Media Studio in Bristol, where we're based, which is this astonishing place. It's a kind of ideas incubation space that's been around for 10 years. It's a joint venture between the two universities in Bristol and the Watershed Media Center that I'm going to go back to in about 25 minutes and spend the rest of my afternoon. And it's a space where you get challenged, and it's a space where ideas happen. But that is also a really interesting place to start looking for us, and also looking for other interesting technology, cultural operators in this sector.
Fantastic. Well, I would not be surprised at all if we're talking to you again in 6 months or 12 months to find out what you've been up to.
I will happily come back, definitely. There are things I've not said today because I'm not allowed to, that I would happily talk about at some point.
Excellent. I look forward to that. Great. Thank you very much, Tom, for your time.
Thanks for listening. Do head over to ambientlit.com to take a look at their projects. Please do rate and review the podcast over on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you happen to be listening. And yes, that's right, we are now at last on Spotify, so it's never been easier to tune in. We've got several online courses kicking off next week, which means it is now your last chance to get in on the action. Many of the courses have already sold out, but places are still available for our young adult fiction and science fiction genre courses. They last 12 weeks, you can study from the comfort of your own home, and they're fully tutored, which means there's an expert on hand throughout the course to give you constructive feedback and improve your writing. To make sure you're always the first to know about upcoming writing opportunities and events, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Writers Centre, like us on our Facebook page, and sign up to our newsletter at nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk. Thanks again, keep writing, and I will catch you on the next episode.